This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
In the next 19 seconds, you could sell your home. Okay, it's not going to sell your home, this, but you're going to take a big step toward getting it sold. Go to realestateagentsitrust.com and find an agent selected by my team, a professional who shares your values and speaks the truth. Sell your home fast and for the most money. Get moving at realestateagentsitrust.com.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. Thank you for being here. Great, as always, to get a chance to hang out with you. Best part of my day, every single day, well, at least every single day that we join together here in the Hut and do radio, is today. We will do Facebook Live today at 3 o'clock. And if it's not really hot, maybe I'll go outside. I just don't want you all to see me sweating and possibly passing out on Facebook Live. Although, now that I say that out loud, I realize it would probably go viral. Maybe it's a better idea than I realized. You know, if I just like thump face on the table. And that, in some ways, is kind of a metaphor for how I feel about this election right now. I referred to it as dispirited in my piece for CNN.com yesterday. I had much stronger language about Hillary's selling her office for access, and I kept getting pushback, and the piece got delayed and delayed all day because of standards and practices over there. It's interesting. My opinion is sometimes not enough for me to say something in an opinion piece. Just putting that out there. So when I say Hillary was clearly selling access, that's my opinion, but it had to be changed through the appearance of selling access and such. I'm like, okay, here we go. But anyway, some interesting thoughts in the piece up on CNN.com. I put it on Facebook.com/Buck Sexton as well, so you can read it. You can read it there. But yeah, it took a while for me to get through the gauntlet over at CNN. They did publish it, so you know they published a piece where I was saying Hillary's selling access, but it was my words were not quite as they were not allowed to be quite as stern as I had initially intended. So that just sort of happens sometimes. Speaking about words and their intentions, we have to talk about Trump today a little bit, guys. I have no alternative if we're going to get into the news of the day a little bit. I've got some other random thoughts to throw out there. I've got some cool guests joining, and it's going to be, don't worry, you'll have the usual Freedom Hut razzle dazzle today. But there's some Trump stuff going on we got to get into. I don't. I hope some of you feel my frustration with all this. This has been not the election year that I had prepared for. It's not the election year that I had wanted. It has been both personally and professionally challenging, would be, I think, a good word. Personally, in the sense that as an American, I see this and I kind of weep. And professionally, because you are caught between Scylla and Charybdis here. Little Greek mythology. It's always good to toss that in. With either supporting Donald Trump or not doing everything you can to defeat Hillary Clinton. Right? Those are the options such as I see them. People can disagree with that and everything else. And I'm kind of psyched that at least I got my man Evan McMullen, ex-agency. So I can just, the easy way out for me is to say, well, I'm voting for my Langley brother and it's like family. So, you know, I got to just go with that, right? I could do that. Maybe that's a cop-out. Maybe it's the more wise option. So there we have it. I don't know. Trump's whole campaign was built on an initial outburst on immigration, as you know. That's what got all of a sudden people go, wow, this guy has captured the imagination of some of the American masses with his talk about immigration. Right? That's definitely a part of how all of this happened. And I've always thought to myself, and people have been asking me ever since I was openly supporting Ted Cruz, doing what I could over it. And I, those of you who ever, if you go back and sort of in the Buck archives of things that I've posted, you'll see that I'd go on there, that they'd call me a Cruz supporter, and somehow every question was about Donald Trump. Never asked about Ted Cruz, because I could have annihilated anybody in a Cruz versus Sanders or Cruz versus Hillary debate, any sort of comparison. They would have had no shot. So they wanted to make me defend Trump. And part of the problem that I had is, unlike some other people over there, who I do think are being disingenuous and maybe even as journalists a bit unethical in being willing to, all along, being willing to defend everything Trump says, or pretend he hasn't said things that he has said, or that words don't have basic meaning. I won't do that. I wouldn't defend Trump on the Muslim ban because of for a whole bunch of reasons. And as you know, I really like Andy McCarthy's work on this issue. I do believe in ideological tests. I do believe in limiting immigration. First of all, limiting immigration as a general principle more than we currently do, but also specifically picking countries and saying, sorry, you got a lot of problems there. We got to use it. Sometimes you do have to use a broad brush. You know, sometimes you do have to say, you know, get your house in order, Pakistan. We can't take too many, you know, with exceptions. You know, if there's a Pakistani, MD who loves America and knows the Constitution better than most Americans, and I'm sure there are plenty of them, yeah, we'll take them, right? But in general, it should. Of course, the issue that everyone always forgets with all this is chain migration. So it's when one person comes and then they sponsor their whole family, and that's what ends up being the reality of our immigration system. It's not that we're picking. When Trump said they're not sending their best, that's true. Well, it's not even that they're not sending their best. We're not getting the best from other countries. We certainly could be, but we are not doing that. That's not what's happening. So where was I? Immigration. It's all built on this promise about immigration. It's all built on this notion that somehow Donald Trump is going to build a wall, as you know, and also that Donald Trump is going to deport, you know, whatever it is, 11 million, 15 million, 20 million people. That's all a part of this. That's what we're constantly being told. What happens if Trump changes that? What happens if all of a sudden we find ourselves in a situation where Donald Trump decides that he's no longer going to sort of stand for these basic ideas that he's built his entire campaign on? What do we think then? Do people change their minds? Do his supporters finally say, you know what, this is too much, can't do this anymore, can't stand beside him and pretend that everything he says is brilliant and great? Then he's playing 4D chess, which I love. I've seen that on Twitter, and people say it in a mocking way because some people have said it seriously. I just think the whole idea is amazing. He's playing 4D chess, man. I'm like trying to think in my head, what would 4D chess even look like? Anybody want to? Anyway, so Trump has built this whole thing on immigration. I've been trying to do what I can to. I just don't want Hillary to win because I just can't deal with 8 years of Hillary going wah, 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 and, equal pay. Wah, wah, wah. It makes me nauseous. It really does. And I'm starting to prepare, by the way, for this nausea. Like, I think I should start taking some Dramamine now, and just that'll become part of my daily routine. So when she goes on TV, she's like, an economy that works for all Americans. People go, oh, she's amazing. Listen to this incredible speech. Listen to that voice, Hillary. Why don't you sing for us? Your voice is amazing.
I just want to make sure that...
Oh, I can't do it. So I'm trying to do what I can to spread the message that Hillary's the worst, as I've told you many times before. And I've also always held out the possibility that Trump could lose my vote. And I've said, I think I even might have said on the show at some point a month or two ago, look, like, let's say he decides all of a sudden, you know, I was just kidding on all that immigration stuff. You know, at that point, I think I just can't stomach it anymore. And I might say I'm done. Trump hasn't said quite that yet. But he has changed his tone a bit. He did a town hall with Sean Hannity last night. Here's what he had to say. Play clip 8.
We have the person, 20 years, been an upstanding person. The family's great. Everyone's great. Do we throw them out or do we work with them and try and do something?
So you're saying there is, and you have been sort of indicating that there will be some flexibility that you originally you had said they're all out and there was a big brouhaha. But you're saying that if somebody can prove that they've been here, proven to be a citizen. But well, here's the big question, though.
Go ahead.
No citizenship.
No citizenship. No
citizenship. Everyone agree with that?
I mean, go a step further. They'll pay back taxes. They have to pay taxes. There's no amnesty as such. There's no amnesty.
Right.
But we work with them.
Is that the position? Because if that's the position, then this was all a ruse. See, I know enough about immigration and immigration policy, and we've talked about it here many, many times in the Hut, to pick apart exactly what Trump is saying. I mean, this is more or less what the sellout Republicans, what the Gang of Eight bill really was offering. Okay, he says no pathway to citizenship. Fine. A lot of Republicans have said there'll be no pathway to citizenship. By the way, can't really ensure that. That could always change. Once you've given somebody permanent legal status, by the way, there will be a much more potent political push for those people to get citizenship, of course, from the Democrats, because they recognize that 70 to 80% of them will vote for the Democrats. So, what do we do? He says that they'll pay back taxes. We've heard this before. That's not true. Most illegal immigrants who are in this country don't earn enough in order to pay any federal income tax. As you know, more than half of the country does not pay any federal income tax. The reality is that they would get money back from the government in the form of earned income tax credit payments. Many thousands of dollars. Hey, you broke our laws. Here's a big check from America and you get to stay forever. That's what they offer. That's what would really happen. And by the way, the first time that any illegal has a child in this country, as you know, anchor babies, we all understand that process. Now, we're not going to be breaking up families. Now there's access to federal benefits. Now all of a sudden, everything changes. If Trump gives up on this deporting even a large number of the 11 million, and I've never thought he was going to do this, which is why I was never willing to say, yeah, this is a great idea, go Trump. I never thought that this was serious. A lot of what Trump has said, it seems, perhaps wasn't serious. Or it's up for negotiation. This is the point that we constantly hear. You've heard me say it as well, that the Democrats who are so terrified of Trump, it's laughable. He's not a fascist. He's pliant. He'll do what people think should be done. He'll listen to what's popular at a given time. He will want to do what people would revere him for, or what his supporters will clap for. He's not a he's not an ideologically rigid guy. I don't even think he has an ideology per se. He has sort of gut instincts about certain things. And I'll be honest with you, I like some of his instincts about certain things. I do appreciate his brash attitude, especially towards the media sometimes. I think that that can be useful. I wish there was a little more of that with Republicans. I wish some of our top Republicans were a little less nerdy, a little less acting like they were trying to audition for an internship at the Heritage Foundation all the time.
Well, I believe in free markets, and I believe in the Constitution, and I believe in the Founding Fathers.
It's like, okay, yeah, we get it. We need somebody who's going to beat the Democrat candidate, who's going to inspire people, who's going to get people fired up, go to the polls, vote. We need somebody who can coerce, who can, verbally, who can bring disparate factions together, who can get things done, who can take principle and turn it into action, right? That's what we actually need as a Republican leader. Not somebody that we all bow down to and revere and think is incredible, and not someone who thinks he's in a competition for how many stanzas, or rather how many lines of the Constitution he can recite, or she. There's been a lot of that in the conservative movement in recent years. It hasn't gotten us all that far. What do we do with Trump now? I don't know. I don't understand what happens at this point. You got, there are two ways to look at it. Let's go through. Here's what Ted Cruz said about Trump's immigration stance quite a while ago during the primary. Play clip 7.
And that's why this New York Times tape is so troubling, because what's been reported is that Donald told the editorial board of the New York Times, what I'm saying on immigration, I don't believe. I'm not going to build a wall. I'm not going to deport people. This is all just rhetoric for the voters. Now, if he didn't say that, he has an easy solution. Simply release the tape.
Did he say that? Looks more and more like that's something that Trump might have said. What I find amazing is that his fans, who, his real fans, I mean, who seem first and foremost to love him for his willing to be honest about things with them, or, you know, his whatever. What I love is that now it seems he has perhaps sold them out on a core issue. And from what I'm gathering, they don't care. It just makes no sense. It just makes no sense. I mean, we'll try to make sense of it here together, but it's kind of driving me crazy. All right, team, sponsor this half hour is My Patriot Supply. Preparedness is essential. Doesn't matter where you are, urban, suburban, rural, anywhere in the country, no matter what's going on, you want to have access to food. You want to make sure you and your family are prepared. I've told you many times a story about what happened when I was here in New York City during Hurricane Sandy. The power grid went down for millions of people in the city, and we were freaked out. We didn't know when we were going to be able to get food. We didn't know when deliveries were going to happen for grocery stores. You don't want to get caught in that situation. So our friends at My Patriot Supply are going to make sure that you are prepared with food no matter what happens. And right now they're giving you a special buy one, get one free offer on a 2-week emergency food supply. Just buy one 2-week food supply for $117, and they'll ship a second one free. Your emergency food supply stores easily and lasts up to 25 years. Take action now. Call 888-394-1029 or online at preparewithbuck.com. That's 888-394-1029 or online at preparewithbuck.com, and we will be right back.
Buck Sexton, dispensing the truth.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
In the next 19 seconds, you could sell your home. Okay, it's not going to sell your home, you're going to take a big step toward getting it sold. Go to realestateagentsitrust.com and find an agent selected by my team, a professional who shares your values and speaks the truth. Sell your home fast and for the most money. Get moving at realestateagentsitrust.com.
So you have Kellyanne Conway out there, who's Trump's new campaign manager or whatever. Kellyanne Conway saying that, she can explain Trump's immigration plan. Okay, let's hear her give it a shot. Play clip
it
six.
Is this week what it's always been. No amnesty, no sanctuary city, so that innocent victims like Kate Steinle, who was murdered right in front of her father in San Francisco over a year ago, Chris, by a man who had been deported 5 times. That should outrage everyone in this country, regardless of their political affiliation. Hillary Clinton is for sanctuary cities. She's for catch and release. She's for open borders. She's actually considerably to the left of President Obama on the issue of immigration. And the only way that the voters are going to know that is if we tell them, because she won't. She's hiding from that. No amnesty from him. No open borders, secure the border, build the wall, have Mexico pay for it, no sanctuary cities, get these businesses to register for E-Verify, to make them more accountable.
If deportation is not still what's happening, then Trump has changed dramatically in his immigration stance. That was the big thing that separated him. Everyone talks about these other things. All the Republicans are, Romney was for E-Verify and self-deportation. That was Mitt Romney, for heaven's sake. All the other Republican, well, not all of them, but a majority of the Republican candidates at least speak about these things. Tougher enforcement. But the enforcement never happens, because who wants to go after the business community for, hiring people to do the jobs Americans won't do? This is an incredible sleight of hand we're seeing underway. I mean, the sort of paramount moment, or the paramount issue of the Trump campaign, deportation of illegals, is being taken if not off the table, is at least being questioned. And I feel like they're trying to see if they can get away with it. Like, well, maybe we can just pull this card out of the deck and nobody will notice. That's really not how it works. That's really not how it's supposed to be. So with that in mind, I just sort of look at this and say to myself, someone's going to have to explain to me why there's not more outrage from Trump supporters that this. I mean, I saw the Hannity town hall last night with Trump and everyone just cheering and cheering and cheering. Did they miss the part where he said that we're going to work with illegals and they're basically all going to get to stay except for the criminals? Because that wasn't his policy all along.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Sexton Show.
Team, I would really like to hear from some of you on this. 888-900-3393. Space on the lines right now. Light him up. If Trump changes his immigration stance, and I mean, this is a flip-flop, right? Let's say what this is. When you say you're going to deport 11 million people and then you change your mind, if Trump does that, what happens? Do his supporters just pretend like it didn't happen? Then I'm actually starting to get a little scared. Then I feel like I'm in some movie where everybody, you know, everybody sort of is praying to the dear leader. And I'm looking around and I'm like, you guys know this is just like some chump who's holding you all, you know, in a sort of state of servitude and the threat of force behind every proclamation, right? Like, that's if the immigration stance changes on this, if there is this I don't know how this was the flip-flop that if this happens, then all bets are off. He hasn't done it yet, but it looks like he's preparing the groundwork for it. I wonder where all of this is going to go. I really do. We're joined now by Heather Wilhelm. She's a columnist for Real Clear Politics and The Federalist. She's written up on The Federalist about the great Ann Coulter immigration bamboozle. Heather, thank you for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
As not warning to you, Heather, it doesn't really matter, but for the audience, just so you know, we are supposed to have Ann on tomorrow to talk about her book. Heather has written about some of the difficulties that Ann may face with the book because of what's going on with Trump. Let's focus on the Trump side of this for a second. Heather, I was told, because the Donald said it, that he was going to deport 12 million people. Now I'm hearing we're going to work with them, and there's a lot of great people who are here illegally. What's going on?
You know, this is amazing, Buck, because Donald Trump never, ever flip-flops, right? He never lies. He never changes his mind. He never waffles. And I'm being sarcastic, obviously. And in this election, this man has, I think he's managed to maybe even outlie Hillary Clinton, which is incredible. It's a Herculean feat. For the past week, you know, the Trump campaign sort of been sniffing around, saying we're going to soften immigration policy. Probably Kellyanne Conway, his new chief advisor, is behind this, is my guess. She's promoted amnesty in the past. But after some vague comments over the past few days, he sat down with Sean Hannity and told him, you know what, illegals can stay. They're going to pay some back taxes, but, you know, we just have to be fair about this, which is hilarious and, you know, and so predictable for 2016. I don't know why people believe Donald Trump about anything. But here we are. He's really backtracked on what was one of his signature proposals when running for the presidency.
I think you could say, I would say that it is his signature proposal. I mean, it's specifically the deportation point, because that's where he was the hardliner, right? That's where he was Genghis Khan on immigration and everybody else was sort of a wimp. And and this was how he was able to sort of, you know, outflank everybody from the right in the primary. And now, I mean, I heard what he's talking. This whole thing about back taxes, we've already been through this before. In fact, illegals won't pay back taxes. They haven't filed taxes, so there's no way that they're going to be able to be, you know, it's going to be on the honor system. And by the way, they don't make enough money to pay taxes, so they're going to get money from the government. I mean, it's a disaster. It's like he has no idea. It is almost like he has no idea what he's talking about, Heather. That's what it felt a little bit like.
He does have no idea what he's talking about, and he's making it up as he goes along. And by the way, this has been completely obvious since the moment he announced his presidential run. I mean, if you've been paying attention, this guy doesn't know anything about anything. He has no core beliefs. He says what he thinks people want to say, and it's completely obvious, which is why I find it really hilarious that Ann Coulter decided to write a whole book entitled In Trump We Trust, and in an odd flick of karma, of course, Trump betrayed her on the very week that her book comes out.
Now, I'm sure some people would say he hasn't officially he's supposed to give a speech. It was supposed to be today. It has not happened yet. So
right.
I'm sure the Trump supporters are clinging to the notion that perhaps this massive flip-flop, and that there's no way, or if it's not deportation of illegals by the millions, it is a massive mm-hmm. flip-flop, and anybody who says otherwise is actually delusional. Like this isn't a discussion that one can have with a sort of a reasonable person and not come to that conclusion.
Right.
He hasn't said that yet, though. Do you think there's a chance that maybe is he trying to sort of anytime you try to come up with a way to explain Trump stuff that makes no sense, but you're trying really hard, I always say it's like 4D chess. This is the thing that, you know, I've stolen from the internet memes. Is there some way that maybe he's trying to get a lot of attention and then show us, oh, actually, no, he is going to deport everybody and get another boost for his campaign? I mean, what could he do here?
Oh, my gosh. He could make 100 U-turns between now and November, as he's shown us he's perfectly willing to do. And it was hilarious. You know, Katrina Pearson, his spokesperson, was on TV saying, you know, he's not changing his policy. He's just changing the words. And, you know, that's just a mind-boggling TV moment. The other panelists literally just broke out laughing because the policy is the words. You know, words mean something. So, of course, there's going to be obfuscation from the Trump camp. And, you know, I personally think this is, look, Conway's looking at the polls, right? He's bombing with women. He's bombing in suburbs. And so they're trying to make him look nicer. But look, this guy's nuts. You know, he could totally change his mind. He could fire his advisors and do another 180, you know, in 2 weeks. But I think that that's the point. And that's what's scary about Trump. And I think that's what people need to figure out. This is a person who has no core beliefs. His beliefs are Trump. And that's a scary guy to have in the White House, quite frankly. I think Trump supporters right now are hanging on to the fact that he's somehow better than Hillary Clinton. And I think if you watch carefully, that's a kind of a tough sell at this point.
Yeah, I feel like a very reluctant Trump supporter whose fingers are slowly slipping off the ledge, you know. I can't hold on much longer. Like, my grip strength is failing me. I'm doing everything I can, and if he flips on this one, I don't know. And you know, there's a sense, I have a sense rather, that there'll have to be some pretty open defections from not the immediate Trump camp, because they're in this no matter what, but from some of the other reluctant Trump supporters out there are going to have to just be like, all right, they're just going to, like, you know, kick over a chair, walk off set and pull off the mic and be like, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, you know, it's, I mean, 2016 has something in it to crack everybody, right? And, you know, I mean, and again, another argument that Trump supporters make is, you know, but Supreme Court, right? But we need the Supreme Court. Again, guys, he has shown no consistency. He has shown, given you no reason to trust him, and you're going to vote for him over that? I mean, to me, it's just mind-boggling. You know, and today, I just read a piece in the Washington Examiner, you know, Ann Coulter is already starting to justify this herself. She said, well, you know, maybe it's okay if some illegals stay. Now, this is Ann Coulter, by the way, who's been talking for months about deportations. And she said, well, you know, at least we're going to get the wall. We're going to get the wall. And I got to ask, why do you think you're going to get the wall? Why do you think the wall is different from any other promise that Donald Trump has made? It's interesting.
I know you're not, you're clearly not a Trump surrogate or a Trump advisor. But if you were to be advising the campaign, I wonder what you think about this. I would tell them that you need to distill down the best version of Donald, not to try to change. We heard just, what was it, yesterday or the day before, that there are, I think it was Kellyanne Conway saying that there's sort of secret Trump supporters that are not represented in the polls. And essentially the only way that Trump wins is if there's this huge surge of primarily working class white voters who just come out in massive numbers, many defecting from the Democratic Party, many that aren't, you know, that haven't voted in the past, and maybe they're registering for the first time, although usually we can see those numbers in advance. That's the only way that he would actually win. And I feel like if Trump is going to do this thing, that is probably, like, he should just be Trump, actually. That this notion that he's going to win over suburban soccer moms by being a nicer, different candidate, I don't see. I feel like that's definitely not going to work. But what do you think?
Oh, if you had to advise them. Oh, well, if I had to advise him, I'd tell him to drop out of the race, quite frankly. I mean, look, you're absolutely right, though. There's no way that Donald Trump, he's got this huge personality. He has impulse control. There's no way he can pretend to be somebody he's not. So I think if you were to advise him, I think that's actually pretty decent advice. And you're right. He's not going to trick a soccer mom into, you know, voting for him after, you know, saying a few nice things about immigration. You know, and Hillary Clinton, meanwhile, is, you know, just laughing, I guess. She doesn't even have to talk to the press. Everybody's distracted by Trump, right? And she, I don't know if you saw this, she released this really, really, really aggressive video today, basically linking Trump to the KKK. You know, I mean, she's just going on all cylinders. And it's a disaster. I mean, what do you tell the guy? I don't know. I mean, this is the, you know, he's the Titanic. It's bad news.
I mean, Heather, right now you're speaking to me, obviously, but people across the country, you're speaking to a lot of conservatives who are listening in. And what are they? So, you know, if from your perspective, what are they supposed to take from all this? I mean, what should we just be like, you know what? Election's over. Let's think about other things and get ready for how to oppose Hillary in 2017. Or should they? I mean, you know, Gary Johnson's running around saying Trump is a fascist, which is just, Trump is a lot of things. He's not a fascist. Gary Johnson is look, Bill Weld, that whole thing is a little clownish for my taste, I'll be honest with you. So, you know, I said before, I've got my Langley brother, Evan McMullen, as an option in there. But what do you tell conservatives?
You know, my strategy, and I think this is really important, is, you know, and one of the, I find this election really sad because, you know, I'm a person who really believes that free market principles help people. I think that ideas like school choice I think that's one of the civil rights issues of our time, you know, and this is getting buried in this clown show. And it's really sad for the Republican Party. And I think Jonathan Last had a really good column in the Weekly Standard today talking about how important it is for people to vote down ballot Republican and to try to save Congress. Because if Hillary Clinton is president, and, you know, again, I understand why people think that's a disaster. I understand why people would choose Trump over her. If she is president, it's hugely important that we keep Congress. That could change a lot of things, and that could make it a lot more tolerable. And also, I think if Republicans stand up for something and stand up for principles and stand up for the right thing and show that we really are for freedom and opportunity, you know, in 4 years, who knows? You know, we could turn the ship around, actually have a decent candidate who, you know, stands for American values and freedom and limited government. I mean, wouldn't that be amazing? I don't think anybody sees that coming. I think everybody's pretty depressed. But in my opinion, that's what I think the smart thing for Republicans is to do, is really focus on down ballot races and try to protect Congress.
All right. Heather Wilhelm, columnist for Real Clear Politics and The Federalist. Heather, thanks so much for calling in. It was good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah. So unless she cancels, we have Ann Coulter on tomorrow to talk about her book. That will be interesting, I think. I like Ann, so I should put that out there for all of you. I'm pro Ann. On this issue, I think we would have plenty to disagree on, or at least I have plenty of very big questions for her. But I'm somebody who likes Anne and thinks that she's done a lot for, if you look at the totality of her career, she's done a lot for the conservative movement. I know with the Trump stuff now, a lot of you are like, well, but, you know, we shall see. 888-900-3393. Team Buck will be right back.
Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network. Dispensing the truth. This is Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
We've got some callers up. Danielle in Dallas, what's up?
Hey, Buck, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
I shouldn't complain. Sometimes I do. So here's my question. A lot of good people support Mr. Cheeto McKinney-Hinz. My curiosity is there a red line at which people actually do drop out, such as yourself? Reasonable guy, you support him because you have to. Where's the red line if it exists?
I think a switch. I think if Trump essentially adopts the Gang of Eight immigration plan as his new platform, then I think a lot of us are out. I do. If he officially does that, and that's the new hotness. I'm sorry.
You said officially does it. Isn't he kind of there today?
He's like flirting with it. You know, he's showing a little Trump leg. He's hiking up the Trump skirt a little bit, but he hasn't yet gone to the dance.
Okay. All right.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
I guess so.
I guess so too. I don't know. I wish I had answers on this stuff now. I look at all this and I just think to myself, and somehow, you know, I can't make. No matter what I say, some conservatives are mad at me. Even if I say I don't know, people get mad at you. So,
no, I'm not mad at my.
Oh no, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about, you know, the rest of them out there. I'm like, guys, what should we? You know, guys, what should we do? They go, what do you mean? What should we do? We have to defeat Hillary. I'm like, okay, I guess.
It ain't gonna happen.
Yeah. Look, the polls. Go ahead.
I was gonna say Trump can win all of the likely Republican states. All of the leaning Republican states, all of the toss-ups, he still gets beat with over 300 electoral votes. It's not happening.
I know. Well, at least, you know, we can go into a comfortable political opposition if Hillary wins. We know what that's like. We've had 8 years of it, so I guess that's the only silver lining here. Danielle from Dallas, always great to talk to you. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show. Appreciate it. Team, we've got more. Back in a few. Stay with me.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, team, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. We're joined now by John Fund. He is an author and columnist. His latest up on nationalreview.com is Democrats Are Right to Worry About an October Surprise. John, always appreciate it. Thank you for the call.
Thank you, Buck.
Before we get into the possible Hillary October surprise that may be coming based on the statements of Assange and WikiLeaks and everything else, could you give us, I thought this was fascinating. In your piece, you go into some of the backstory of a fundraising scandal the Clintons dealt with before that I feel like a lot of people have forgotten about.
Well, it was 20 years ago during 1996's Clinton reelection effort, and it broke in the last month of the campaign. It was shorthanded the John Wong scandal. He was a Commerce Department official who later became the deputy finance chairman of the Democratic National Committee, raising money for Bill Clinton. And it was a holy mess. We didn't learn everything before the November 96 election, but afterwards, 120 people had either pled guilty, fled the country, taken the Fifth Amendment, or otherwise refused to answer questions. 22 people were convicted of various charges. The Chinese were found to have tried to influence the U.S. elections by funneling money to the Clinton campaign. There were congressional hearings, which unfortunately the Clinton administration was able to stonewall because that was the thing they did best back then and today. But enough came out before the election that it moved voters. The Republicans were in danger of losing control of the Senate and the House before the scandal. They ended up actually breaking even. And Bob Dole, who was behind between 11 and 18 points in the last polls before the election, ended up only losing by 8.
So this is the kind of thing where October surprise, I mean, usually when people refer to October surprise, right, it has to do with the hostages and there was this whole conspiracy. But sometimes there are real surprises in October that can move the election as opposed
That broke and metastasized and had, you know, pictures of a guy trying to escape subpoenas and witnesses because he didn't want to talk before the election. That would be John Wong and Charlie Tree and various other people. You now have figures in the Clinton Foundation, whether it's Doug Band or David Chang or various other people who don't want to answer questions, Huma Abedin, and the same thing. So we already are seeing more revelations than we thought we would see. And Julian Assange today is on the network saying, I have significant Hillary documents and they will be released before the election through WikiLeaks. So if you put all those together, I think there's going to be some kind of an October surprise. How big and how meaningful, I don't know.
Based on what we've seen so far, do you think it's fair to say that Hillary Clinton, do we have enough to say that Hillary Clinton was selling access to her office, not necessarily favors, but selling access, actions as opposed to just access? Or do we have to still say the appearance of access?
Well, there's a legal standard and there's a political standard. The legal standard, you have to have a lot of proof. You have to show a quid pro quo, which in Latin means you do this, I do this. And that's rarely given proof in email or telephone form or person to person. Politically, it sure looks like the Clinton administration and the State Department, the Clinton Foundation and the State Department had basically merged. And, you know, Hillary Clinton, ironically, opposes privatization of every government department, but apparently she thought the State Department was neat and should be merged with the Clinton Foundation in sort of a public-private partnership.
And this was all done in such a way that it allowed them to fund tremendous amounts of private travel all over the world, to pay cronies. I mean, I think that's part of why, you know, the way that most people probably read about this or hear about it, it's a charity. How did the Clintons benefit from the charity, personally?
The day Bill Clinton left office, his wife was already a senator from New York. The understanding that everyone had was that she'd be running for president, and if she ran, she'd probably be the front runner for the Democratic nomination. If she became president, she would be leader of the free world. So the Clinton Foundation became a magnet for people who wanted to curry favor with the Clintons and buy chits for the time when she became president. Well, it turned out she had a wrong turn with Barack Obama in 2008. She ended up being Secretary of State instead. But that still was very useful because the Secretary of State directs foreign policy. So she turned the Clinton Foundation into a vehicle by which people thought, at least even if they weren't told directly, they certainly thought that they could get access and get certain things if they gave to the Clinton Foundation first and then tried to talk to her or aides at the State Department.
And this also is all right. If you write a check for $1 million to the Clinton Foundation, you get a tax write off. It's a charity, so it's not even people are paying for access, but they get also a tax break in the process.
Depending on some foreign countries don't allow that, but
oh no, I meant for U.S. citizens though.
Oh yes. Now, but the foreign citizens, I mean, really problematic. I mean, these people who were trying to get this uranium deal, I mean, it turned out that 20% of the uranium production of the United States is now controlled by entities close to Vladimir Putin and Russia. That happened in part because the State Department signed off on it, and the people behind that uranium deal gave enormous amounts of money, millions, to the Clinton Foundation. Now, I can't prove that there was a quid pro quo, but it sure smells like a quid pro something.
And isn't the appearance of corruption often enough for at least for federal investigators to begin a?
There's already a probe going on. Just because the FBI had one probe shut down doesn't mean there isn't another probe currently happening as a result of the email server investigation. Because they found a whole bunch of emails Hillary Clinton had deleted. She deleted 33,000 emails because she didn't want people to ever see them. Well, apparently the FBI has recovered a bunch of them, and they are pursuing leads that they find in those emails.
Do you think there's anything that Julian Assange can show with regard to corruption within the Clinton Foundation? I mean, let me just give you a hypothetical, John. And, you know, you've covered a lot of elections, been doing this for quite a while. If there's an email that says, OK, you know, we'll take action on this because he's so and so You know, because Oleg has been such a great donor to the Clinton Foundation, let's take action on this issue. If that email came out there, putting aside any legal issue that it could pose for Hillary Clinton herself, do you think Clinton supporters would care? I feel like I'd see a bunch of them on CNN and MSNBC and everywhere else saying, oh, well, this is how secretaries of state do business in the 21st century. I feel like it wouldn't change their minds.
Well, I am sure that some previous secretaries of state have occasionally done business like that. I think the difference is the following. One, Hillary Clinton turned it into a systematic habit. It was the essence of her time at the State Department. Secondly, look, it's not the Clinton voters that you're worried about. It's the independents and who would stay home and who would just simply be disgusted at both candidates, or candidates who simply say, I don't like Hillary or Trump, but, you know, Trump is really obnoxious, but Hillary is corrupt, so I might vote for Trump. It's not the Clinton supporters. The Clinton supporters are, you know, the Kool-Aid drinkers. It's the sliver of the voters in the middle. And remember, the easiest thing to do in a presidential election is to stay home. You don't have to vote. And if there are enough doubts about Hillary Clinton, lots of people won't vote.
Now, I know we're talking Hillary and the possibility of a Cyber October surprise is something I find just sort of fascinating as a concept. I think it's, we'll see. I have a sense it'll be kind of more of what we've already seen. I doubt that Hillary, even with control of her own email server, would have been so foolish as to put in an email an obvious quid pro quo.
She may not have, but perhaps her aides did.
Right. Well, I think that's why that was one of the main justifications in her mind for the private server in the first place, was it was sort of a fail-safe. Where if somebody sent her something saying, hey, I wrote you that big check, I expect action on this, even if she didn't necessarily respond or whatever, it would look really bad because then people would explicitly expect a quid pro quo. And maybe one of her aides would have said, okay, well, you did take it. You know, I think that's why she wanted control of it, but we have to sort of see what's in there. But I have to also ask you about Trump, John.
He'll have an October surprise, too.
What do you mean?
Oh, I think... Look, part of Mitt Romney's IRS tax returns leaked in the last month of the campaign in 2012. Do you think that's not going to happen this year? Of course it's going to happen. Some of Donald Trump's IRS information will leak out, and I can give you the odds of anyone in the IRS ever being punished for leaking will be the odds that Lois Lerner ever serves time in prison, which is not going to happen.
Now, why do you think Trump is not releasing his tax returns? This does seem to be it seems strange even to stalwart Trump supporters, I think, who are willing to at least be honest about what's going on.
Well, his son said the other day, my dad would be foolish to release the returns. Well, I agree with him. I think they're going to show three things, if they are all released in total. There might be selective leaks. I think they're going to show his net worth is not over $10 billion, as he claimed, or at least implausibly not worth that. I think it's going to show that because he's in real estate and takes aggressive use of deductions, he paid a very low effective tax rate, lower than many Americans. And three, I think his charitable contributions, at least those that he claimed on his tax returns as opposed to those that he made privately and didn't deduct, will be not as high as people think he is or he has led people to believe they are.
Do you think those would, again, now we have to focus in on who matters, people who may vote for Trump? You think that changed, you know, independents and people who might stay home, you think that affects their calculation?
Well, it depends on what they think Trump's important themes are. You know, some of his themes are immigration and anti-Hillary and, you know, building better trade deals. But some of the people are impressed by Trump because he's a businessman who, you know, wants to help the common man. Well, if he's a businessman who's not nearly as successful as he claims to be, and if he ended up aggressively making sure that he'd paid as little tax as possible, it makes him sound like somebody who's in it for himself and deceiving people. So I don't know. Again, the problem is not Trump voters voting for Hillary. The problem is Trump voters staying home. That's the issue. Because 40% of people don't vote for president. It could be 45 or 50% this year.
Could Trump could his candidacy, you think, survive an official shift on immigration away from deportation towards what sounds a lot like the very much rejected and denounced Senate Gang of Eight immigration bill? That's kind of, he's hitting some of those points.
No. Look, the fundamental distinction between the Gang of Eight immigration bill and anything else that anyone has talked about is citizenship.
Pathway. Yeah, I know. He says that. But you can't guarantee there won't be a pathway put in the future.
can anyone guarantee anything?
Yeah, okay,
but
fine.
Donald Trump, I think, knows that there are limits to what he can retreat on the immigration issue. I think what he's dealing with now is the practical reality that you don't deport 11 million people. And, you know, for whatever reason, he's decided to make that explicit. If anyone actually believed that 11 million people were going to be physically picked up and moved across the border, they have a much higher opinion of the quality and ability of U.S. law enforcement to do things than I do. And, you know, I come from a family. My brother was deputy chief of police in Tucson, worked on the border for 40 years. I know something I'm talking about. The bottom line is, as long as Donald Trump doesn't explicitly say, you know, I want to have immigration reform that includes a path to citizenship and has no consequences for the people who broke the law and came here, I think he holds most of his votes on that issue. Because in the end, people do want a wall built. They do want a crackdown on illegal immigration. I don't think they believe 11 million people are going to be deported.
I don't know, John, and this is just an opinion. You don't think that a lot of his supporters...
Have you actually believe that 11 million people are going to be deported?
I never believe that.
They want them deported, but they actually don't believe it will happen.
No, you don't think that Trump supporters thought that he was going to really deport? I think a lot of them did believe this. I think they did, whether it's crazy or not is a different
question.
Well,
Donald Trump also believes that you could go down to Fifth Avenue and he could take out a gun and shoot someone and he wouldn't lose any of his base voters. I guess we're going to find out, aren't we?
I think we are going to find out something along those lines, because if he changes on deportation...
No, I don't think he's changing any more than he has already, which is he's basically said we need to enforce the laws we have. We need to take crack down. We need to first send out the criminals among the illegal alien population, and we have to build a wall. And he hasn't retreated from that. If he goes further, then we have a conversation. I don't think he's actually retreated as far as you think he has.
All right. Well, we'll see what the Trump supporters make of all this, and we'll certainly
they're going to call in and let you know shortly.
Oh, just wait till my Facebook page gets lit up. John Fund, columnist and author. John, what's your latest book?
It's Obama's Enforcer. The Justice Department, and it's by Broadway Books, and it's available on Amazon, Obama's Enforcer, and it's all about how the Obama administration has subverted our Constitution and taken away our civil liberties.
All right. Everyone check it out. John, always appreciate your time, sir. Thanks for the call today.
Thank you.
Team, we have more coming up. Stay with me.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network. Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
All right, we have Louisa in North Carolina on the line. Louisa, what's up?
Hello, my friend. Look, when I was listening this morning, the lady from the Federalist, my head almost exploded. Boom. Why? Because, my friend, we have the House, we have the Congress, and still we can stop Obama Marxism. We can't. What kind of guarantee we have if we keep the House and the Congress, we will stop the crazy Marxist Hillary Clinton? None. Zero. Nada. At least Trump has the intentions to protect the military, American military, the borders. He can say whatever he wants from the 20 million illegals here already. But at least his intention is faithful with the people. I am American citizen since 2010, and I feel pain how the Americans let the Marxists take over the country. I came from Venezuela, and it's a nightmare the each Marxist I met in my life. When I was in the university, I was Marxist. I starting to read the life of Marx and Engels. These couple of miserable men were racist, miserable, egocentric, selfish rats. This is the reason I hate the Marxism. And to me, it's amazing. And this time, I am entering panic how the Americans still will vote for Hillary when she offered open borders to destroy America. for love of Jesus Christ, please, Americans, open the mind. Hillary will continue Obama's destroying America. Stop. Go.
Luisa, I appreciate your passion, and it's always always interesting to hear from someone who has come to this country and seen what it's like here versus what it's like in another place where they do have statism and collectivism as official policy. Venezuela.
Yes, and you know what, my friend? I don't like when Pat, Stu, and Glenn are saying, don't forget to vote for Congress and House to try to keep 4 more years of Hillary. No. We sent to Iran $400 million. Who signed it? Who signed the check? Who? Republicans and Democrats. Both. Who will stop the Muslim terrorists enter here? Hillary? No. At least Trump will try to stop these freaking terrorists.
I hear you. I think that he is much more has much greater animosity towards Islamism and jihadism than Hillary, and that's largely a product of Hillary coming from a left which has sort of embraced in a very bizarre way, and what I've described on this show many times before, have embraced a sort of imperialistic and anti-American Islamist expansion. I mean, they seem to be in favor of this, so and they defend it at every turn. Luisa, really appreciate you holding. I really appreciate you sharing.
One more thing.
Oh yeah, one more. We only have about 30 seconds, but go ahead.
Okay, 30 seconds. Read. Germany is calling to save food and water. Why Merkel equal Hillary? That's it.
All right, Luisa. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Yeah, by the way, look up what's going on in Venezuela. It just keeps getting worse in Venezuela all the time. And it should be kept in mind. This is a country that should be and was. It was well off regionally. It should be well off based on the amount of money it has had from oil over the years. Largest proven oil reserves in the world. And now they are conscripting people into the workforce because they don't want to work because they can't get paid and they can't produce anything. And the whole place is falling apart. What did it all start with? Well, there's a lot of wealth inequality, so let's put a socialist in charge. Not good, my friends. Bad idea. Very bad indeed. All right, we'll talk a bit more immigration. We'll get into some national security and some other fun stuff. So, team, stay with me.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show,
only on the Blaze Radio Network.
I'm sorry that all of you can't always hear what's going on in the break, because John's rocking the board today. We were just doing a little freestyling, and maybe there was some, I mean actual freestyling instead of like Freestyle Friday, maybe some beatboxing. Things get a little wild. I don't know, maybe John or I was singing along to some jazz hold music. That could have happened. Maybe it was John, maybe it was me. We'll never know. Don't tell anyone, John. All right, we're joined now by Israel Ortega. He is a columnist. He's written a piece up on thehill.com. Here's what Trump should say in his immigration speech. Israel, great to have you. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, Buck. Appreciate it.
All right. What should he say? Go to it.
Well, I think, look, he's got to realize that his idea of deporting, 12 to 15 million people is both impractical and prohibitively expensive. It's just a recipe for big government. So I think, him kind of back.
Wait, do we lose Israel? I'm sorry, I lost you for a second. Him doing what?
I'm sorry. Yeah, him necessarily, him going back on this idea that he's going to deport 12 to 15 million people. It's just common sense. I mean, from the very beginning, it was just a ludicrous idea. And so I think him just saying, look, we're going to deal with the folks who have committed crimes, and then we'll figure out a way to to bring into the fold people who have been here for generations. That makes sense. And I mean, you know, even Republicans agree with that. I mean, I was struck by exit polls this spring in places like Texas, for example, where a majority of Republicans were comfortable with the idea of legalizing undocumented immigrants. So I think it's a no-brainer here. This is the way he ought to be doing it.
So you think that it's smart policy. How do you think this is going to play? Because I got to be honest with you. I'm sort of sitting here saying, I remember in the early days of the Trump campaign when it was, you know, we're going to deport 11 million and everyone's freaking out and loving it so much and everything. And he changes on this issue. Trump supporters don't care at all. It's not like this is something that he tossed in there. Like the Muslim ban was in response to a terrorist attack. It sort of, you know, he talked about it and it was off the cuff and then he said it again. And this was the very beginning of the Trump surge deporting people. And now, I mean, I agree with you. I never thought this was going to happen, but I feel like Trump supporters did think it was going to happen. And now somehow they don't care.
Yeah, no, it's amazing because even Ann Coulter just recently, I think was quoted as saying that it may not be a bad idea to allow some illegal immigrants to stay in the country. So it seems like, you know, the people that would be jumping at this and saying, oh, this is amnesty, you know, are basically giving Donald Trump a pass. So with that, I mean, then it's like, look, you know, a majority of Americans believe that we ought to bring into the fold people who have been living here in this country, with the exception, of course, of people who have committed crimes, because I think that's something that even Hillary Clinton until recently was saying that people who have committed crimes ought to go. So there's no risk for Donald Trump to do this. He's got to just pivot from this and really start being more presidential and being more serious. And by doing this on immigration, I think it's a good start.
Now, do you think it's fair to say, and of course, we're looking into the future, so this is an assessment, not a statement of fact, but is it fair to say that Trump pivoting on this issue, and people are, there are like memes about Trump pivoting now all the time. People make lots of jokes about all the Trump pivots that have happened or that have been promised that haven't happened, actually, is really the way it's gone down. But do you think that this is going to perhaps help Trump with his very poor numbers, with college-educated whites, with suburban moms, etc., but not with Hispanics and Latinos? I don't think that this is going to – that softening this stance on immigration is going to make much difference in the Latino vote, or will it?
No, I think you're right, Buck. I mean, I think for most Hispanics, I mean, it's unforgivable, you know, what Trump has done. In terms of, you know, the whole thing about rapists and really just even from that point. So, yeah, I think in many cases, I think the Hispanic community, that vote is sort of set. I'm less hopeful about that. But I think you're right. It's more about the college educated population. It's about suburban moms. I mean, I think if he can moderate on immigration, he can seem more serious, because I think that's the big knock on him now, is that he's not serious. I mean, a lot of the policies that he throws out there are just not are impractical. So I think if he does this, he might be able to cut into that lead, because, you know, when you look at places like Missouri, where he's only clinging on to a 1-point lead. I mean, if you're not winning Missouri, you're in trouble. And so I think that this is a start, but obviously he's got a lot to do to catch up.
Now, on the issue of the wall, you think he might actually try to build a wall, or is that also up for discussion?
No, I mean, that's another idea where, I mean, you're talking about, as you know, I mean, the wall, I mean, our U.S.-Mexico border is vast, and you've got places where, you know, you've got private property, there's water. I mean, there's different, you know, just different degrees of complexity there. So I think it's more about Donald Trump saying, look, we're going to secure the border. That may include bringing in technology to do that, to make sure that we know who's coming in. I mean, that's the way to do it. I mean, this is something that you've got support in Congress to do, but it's got to be done right. And the idea of just kind of throwing money and you know, throwing out this idea that we're going to just have this impenetrable wall, again, it's just something that, you know, just doesn't square with reality. So it was always one of those things where you make promises, but at the end of the day, I think now that we're getting closer to the election, he's got to get even more serious.
Can he win, in your opinion? Do you think he can pull this off?
Well, it's going to be a haul. I mean, there's 11 weeks left before the election. Not a whole lot of time, but look, you know, there are things that we don't know about. I mean, those emails that Hillary Clinton is still dealing with. You've got you know, the possibility that Trump could have an amazing debate performance. Hillary Clinton just collapses, for example. I mean, those are factors that could definitely shape this race. And you know, anything is possible. You know, 11 weeks is a long time, but in many ways, you know, it's got the possibility of really turning back and turning in the favor of Trump.
Israel Ortega is a senior writer for Opportunity Lives. He's got a piece up on the Hill right now. Here's what Trump should say in his immigration speech. Israel, really appreciate you joining us on the show today. Thank you for calling in.
Thanks, Buck. Appreciate it.
Team, we have more. We also have phone lines open, 888-900-3393. If you're on hold, stay with me. We'll get to you in just a few.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show.
We got Rob calling in from Atlanta. What's up, Rob?
Well, sir, I want to thank you for some of the best analysis on the air and on the internet for your show. It's
thank you so much.
Very educational and wonderful.
Thank you
to hear. But I've got a question that's been bothering me because you're such a smart guy, and that is, why do you continue to live behind enemy lines in liberal New York City when you could potentially live, I know, in Texas because of the Blaze's headquarters, or even Atlanta? I would point out the CNN offices are down the street just in case you need to jump in there and do a quick spot. The women are prettier in both cities, definitely are better morally grounded and more plentiful and more conservative. And yet you continue to live in a city run by a communist mayor, and I submit that if Hillary does win, things are not going to be good for you in New York, worse than anywhere else.
Oh, man, you make a compelling case, Rob. The main reason I'm here in New York is, it's my hometown. I was born and raised here, so this is the place that's most familiar to me. I mean, it feels the most like home. But bigger than that is where my whole family's here. I have two brothers and a little sister. They're all in town. My parents are here. I've got a whole bunch of cousins, aunts, uncles, all the rest of it. Everybody's in New York City. The whole Sexton crew. I mean, there's a lot of us running around and sort of extended family as well. So it's mostly for family. I will also say, and this might upset some people in other parts of the country, we do have the best food in the world. So, I mean, there's that. There is that. It is the best food you could get anywhere on the planet. I know people disagree with that, and that's fine. On the point about women, as I sit here unmarried and unengaged, all I can tell you is you make some interesting points. You make some interesting points, Rob.
I would say, just remember, you can get the whole family to move into safety. It's like you're a refugee, really, Buck. You got to think and start selling it to your family that way, the way the country is going. Get them out of high-tax New York before it's too late anyway, and yeah, it'll be better for everyone.
Rob, I'm sure at least one of my parents is listening, and maybe even some of my siblings, and maybe we'll have I'm going to be up with them next week. I'm taking some days off vacation. Maybe we'll have a little chat at the Sexton compound upstate and talk about how maybe we should go somewhere where, I don't know, there's no state taxes and it's like Second Amendment friendly, and there's all kinds of reasons to go check it out.
Absolutely.
All right, man, Rob. I appreciate it, Rob. Thank you for the kind words and also the life advice. I'll take it. Mike in PA, what's up, buddy?
Well, Buck, I was thinking that you could give a present to your friend that's, I believe, running for Congress. Am I right?
I'm sorry, what?
You got a former associate that's, you said, a Langley friend or something?
Oh, a Langley brother is running for president. Yeah. Yeah, Evan McMullen.
Okay. I'm sorry, I was getting that confused.
That's all right.
So for your district, have you got somebody that's conservative running for Congress in
your
no,
area?
No, I think my district, it might be like Maloney or somebody. It's somebody who's like might as well be a member of a member of the Chinese Central Committee as far as their politics are concerned. Mm-hmm. I have no idea.
You're familiar with the Freedom Caucus of the U.S. Congress, right?
Yes.
Okay. I was thinking there's a gift that maybe you could give to them to help them in their like folks like Louis Gohmert.
Okay.
An audio version of the Constitution read by Buck Sexton himself.
It's a very nice idea, Mike. I don't know how far I'd go with that. It sounds a little bit like Obama giving a podcast of speeches to like heads of state, a podcast of his speeches. But I like where your head's at in general. I'll say that. Mike from Pennsylvania, good to talk to you. Thank you. Thank you very much for calling in. Yeah. We'll play that audio in the next hour. Thanks, John, for pulling that up. I asked John to do like five tasks at once when he's running the board all the time, and he somehow manages to always do it. So thank you, John. And I had a guy come up to me just outside of a clothing store here in New York, and he came up, and I had a feeling, and I shouldn't just judge based on clothing and the fact that I'm in New York City and everything else, but I figured this guy's probably a liberal. And he comes up and he goes, this just happened yesterday. He says, are you that guy from CNN? Now, when somebody says, are you that guy from The Blaze, or are you that guy who fills in for Rush? I always want to be like, yes, I am. Are you Dr. Galakowicz? Yes, I am. And because I feel like I'm going to get a hug or a high five or something, and I'm always really excited about it. When someone says, are you that guy from CNN? I'm kind of like, maybe, because in New York City, I don't know where that's going to go necessarily, right? I had a guy actually in the gym recently, a place where I should spend more time, and I have been trying to, but should spend a lot more time, come up to me, and he was like, hey, I think I saw you before on the TV. And I was like, yeah, that might have been me. Sometimes I do some things over there. And he goes, all right. He's kind of walked away. I was like, well, I'm glad we established that, buddy. Thanks. But so yesterday I'm outside this department store, and this guy comes over, and he was wearing loafers, no socks. Okay. So I figured he's either he's into yachting or he's a liberal. What could I tell you? And, he's like, are you that guy from CNN? And I say, yeah, I'm that guy from CNN. And it's right here in my neighborhood in sort of, downtown Manhattan. Which is a stronghold of leftism and all the rest of it. I mean, the real estate is so expensive that I live, in a very tastefully decorated closet. But nonetheless, everyone here is a makeshift socialist. Anyway, he goes, well, I saw you on CNN recently, and I'm not even a conservative, but I just wanted to tell you that after the attack in Nice, France, there was that panel, and everybody else in that panel was crazy, and you were the only person who made sense. And I thought it was, he said he thought it was blanking awesome, which made me really happy. I'm like, yeah, get some, dog. And it was just really nice. So I appreciated that. So I just want to share that little story. So this has made me think of it because I am behind enemy lines here in New York City. Even though this is my hometown, and I kind of feel like I don't want to abandon it to the progressive lunatics, and they already are running the asylum, and they think that I'm the crazy one. But occasionally I do come across people who are either Team Buck. That's my favorite, obviously. Or people, it's nice when people see me from CNN as long as they have nice things to say. Sometimes I feel like I did have a guy in the subway once who was like, he's like, I've seen you on CNN. And he's like, I disagree with everything you say, but you say it I think he said aplomb or gusto or something like that. He used like kind of a cool SAT word. And that was, so I'll take that. That was nice too. It's better than when I go on CNN and people say that I'm a moron and I look like Mrs. Doubtfire. So, it's nicer than that. I'll take that. All right, team. Third hour national security coming up. Got a whole lot more to discuss with you. As always, phone lines open 888-900-3393. Want to send me your thoughts? Facebook.com/BuckSexton. We are posting things throughout the show, tidbits for you to read, all kinds of fun stuff. Team, hour three is upon us. Stay with me.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
spreading freedom across the nation. This is
The Buck Sexton Show.
All right, Team Buck, it's hour three. It's time for a Buck Brief.
You are entering the Blaze Threat Ops Center. This is a secure space. All outside comms are down. Prepare to receive the Buck Brief.
Joined now by Adam Credo. He is of the Washington Free Beacon, where he writes on national security matters. Adam, great to have you as always.
Thanks for having me, buddy.
So let's talk. We got a few things happening in the world of NatSec. First of all, Iran has made a high-speed intercept of a U.S. ship. People are saying this was a harassing maneuver. What's going on here?
Yeah, it is a harassing maneuver, to say the least. This is kind of part of the way Iran's behavior has only increased in aggression since the nuclear deal. They've done this more than one time. They routinely harass U.S. ships in the Persian Gulf area, and now we see this event. It's very similar behavior to that of their ally, Russia, who also routinely buzzes our planes and tries to cause general havoc. My question here is about the U.S. reaction. It said we set off some flares, et cetera. I'm wondering if a more aggressive response to this would have sent a real message to the Iranians.
And I'm assuming the administration doesn't want to hear any talk about how Iran continues to be more belligerent, to be more willing to sort of thumb its nose at America in the aftermath of this Iran deal that I thought was supposed to bring us all together and make us friends.
Precisely. I mean, that was the rhetoric here, bringing the Iranians into the community of nations, moderating their behavior. None of those things has happened since the nuclear deal. It's only emboldened the Iranians. They traveled to Latin America. They recently had a delegation over there meeting with Cuba, Venezuela, no friends of the U.S. They continue to cause destabilizing actions across the Middle East, their behavior in Syria, in Iraq, other words, and at the same time also continue to fund their global terror operation. I know you note it all the time, but it's worth stating again, they're the foremost state sponsor of terror across the globe.
And by the way, what is we see this Al-Qaeda leader Zawahiri urges Iraq Sunnis to wage guerrilla war as ISIS loses ground. So we've got the head of Al-Qaeda proper telling Sunnis in Iraq that they need to go into insurgency phase now, right?
Yeah, of course. I did see this. This was a Reuters report that came out earlier today. And not surprising, look, we're witnessing the continuation of a sectarian war in the Middle East. We can't deceive ourselves. Yes, there are terrorist forces mounting, and all of them are very much anti-Western and anti-U.S., but in terms of the region, this is sectarian warfare. The Iranians on one side, ISIS on another side, Al-Qaeda now supporting ISIS. It's in very simple terms, a mess, and we're doing nothing.
Well, we are doing something. We are paying the Iranians some cash and hoping that maybe, I don't know, that influences their behavior one way or another. I mean, I agree we're doing nothing worthwhile, or very little that is worthwhile in the Middle East right now. But the administration, you have a piece up on the Free Beacon about this. They don't want to talk about, this goes back to the issue of the leverage payment, because we don't want to say ransom
right
here, because that's inflammatory. The ransom payment the administration made, it was only a partial, it was a partial amount of the $1.3 billion that we said we were going to give them. And now the administration won't say how the rest of it was given to them. What's going on?
Well, look, they've barely given us the details about the $400 million payment. And you're right, that was just a small fraction of the $1.7. The other $1.3 billion was an interest payment given from U.S. taxpayer funds. So we have that to look at, too. But the only reason we know about how the $400 million was transferred is because of a newspaper reporter, Jay Solomon from the Wall Street Journal, actually did the legwork and was able to get people to talk about it. This wasn't because the administration wanted us to know. And it's very similar with this $1.3 billion payment. I've spoken to the Treasury Department, or at least tried to. I've spoken to the State Department. And neither of them will give the details about this payment. They won't get into it. So, again, we're left to wonder exactly how the money got over there. Was it wire transferred? Was it done in a cash payment again? Who helped bring the money over there? We know we can't send them U.S. funds, so somebody would have had to essentially launder the money by turning it into other currency. All of these things we just don't know. And the second piece of this is that Congress doesn't know either. They can't get answers out of the administration on their end.
Now, this is interesting, too, because Obama came out and said that, and he was very very aggravated, very dismissive as well of people who said that there was anything at all that looked fishy or that smelled fishy about the $400 million cash payment to Iran on this plane. The hostages were held until they knew that this exchange was happening. Okay, fine. He said it's because we are so good at keeping Iran out of the banking system that we can't do this. We won't do the wire transfer. And also there are congressional laws in place that prevent using the banking system to transfer money to Iran. That's why there had to be a cash payment. So if we were to find out now that, oh, by the way, we also did a wire transfer, then the president would have been lying to the American people, right? I don't see what the options are. Either we haven't paid them the money, we paid them in cash, in which case we've done more of the $400 million sort of cash pallets for them. Or I think the worst option for the administration is we gave them some cash because they wanted like the unmarked bills to give to whomever. And we also sent them a wire transfer, despite the fact we said that that was illegal. None of these look particularly good for the Obama administration.
No, it would certainly throw a wrench into their rhetoric and their explanation of this. But my gut tells me from reporting on this for years now that it's some combination of these two. I'm not entirely certain that it's possible to turn $1.3 billion into hard currency and get it over to Iran, although it's not out of the realm of possibilities. But I can tell you the money got there somewhere. The Iranians already have it. The administration will confirm that. It's their money now, and it came from a taxpayer fund set up here in the United States. So from that angle, look, there's no strings attached. The Iranian government's already boasted that U.S. money has gone to fund their military. It wouldn't shock me if this money does as well. I can assure you they're not putting it into the economy. They're not putting it into helping their people. They're not putting it into encouraging small business growth or something along these lines.
And what do you think about the incursion that Turkey made into northern Syria yesterday? What do you make of that? This is we've got Turkish tanks, warplanes, special operations going into Syria. This is the sort of the biggest military operation in Syria that the Turkish government has made yet. A lot of moving pieces here. What do you see?
I actually have to say that I'm not particularly surprised by this. This kind of relates back to what we were saying before, the sectarian war that's being waged in the Middle East. Now, the U.S. is not there. We don't have a very strong presence in the region. We've pulled back. We've abandoned our allies. And this is what happens when the U.S. behaves in this manner. We see more and more countries feeling forced into a corner and forced to join this war. Is it going to help matters? Probably not. But I understand why the Turks feel the pressure to have to do this and to say to themselves, we can't have these terrorists on our borders, infiltrating our borders, and potentially recruiting in our country.
And the Kurds and the Turks continue to have this very serious problem, despite the fact that we're using, or we're hoping and continue to use, the Kurdish ground forces as really our most effective proxy against ISIS in northern Syria. So it's interesting. You've got, you know, the Russians backing Assad, who and the Russians engaging in airstrikes against non-ISIS groups as much as they are against ISIS groups. Right. They're just going after anybody who's a threat to the Assad regime. You've got the Turks helping us against ISIS, but also going after the Kurds and dropping bombs on the Kurds. We're assisting the Kurds to fight. I mean, this is a giant freaking mess.
It's a mess, and it's a sectarian war, and that's often how these wars get played out. We use the excuse of ISIS or other terror groups to also target the people that we have longstanding hostility for, and that's what we're kind of seeing with the Turks. And I'd also throw into the equation the Iranians are working with the Russians in Syria as well to combat ISIS, but also, you know, the opponents who want to take out Assad. So, yeah, you're right. It's a mess, and it only gets bigger because the U.S. is not aggressively doing anything in the region. There would be ways for the United States to send messages to get the Russians out of there, but this administration doesn't want to have any of it. They're very war fatigued at this point.
Adam Credo is a senior writer at the Washington Free Beacon covering national security. Read his latest at the Free Beacon. And what's your Twitter handle, sir?
It is Credo Zero, K-R-E-D-O Zero.
All right, team. Those of you who are on Twitter, follow the man. Adam, thank you for calling as always, buddy. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it as well. Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. Team, we got more. Be right back.
This is the Buck Sexton Show
on the Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
You know, I had a discussion yesterday with some friends here in the city, and we talked a bit about foreign policy, and one of the things that came up was the notion of blowback, and I thought this was very interesting. You know, you hear this a lot. People will talk about how the U.S. has made all these mistakes in the Middle East, which have led to all these problems, and I always feel like it's sort of similar to saying when you're in a really bad neighborhood with a lot of crime, you know, the police have just messed this place up, man. I mean, the police are just, you know, they arrest for petty things and they don't have good enough relationships with the community. That's a legitimate discussion to have. But if that's the only discussion, then you're missing a much broader picture. And I think of U.S. policy in the Middle East in sort of similar terms. This is happening right now. We're just discussing a Turkish incursion into Syria, Iranian troops, I mean, an Iranian military intervention that's going on in Syria, Russian planes taking off from Iranian air bases to attack Assad's enemies in Syria. This notion that if the U.S. was somehow not making mistakes or even not involved, I mean, this is where the sort of non-interventionist line, I think, begins to run into a lot of, or I should say people don't like isolationist because it has a pejorative attached to it, or it's too simplistic a position, right? It's an absolutist position that you're forcing people into. Non-interventionism is a more nuanced place for everyone to be. And that's where you get into the, well, maybe we shouldn't make everything our problems. That's true. And we don't make, and of course, it's always kind of funny, isn't it? We don't make everything our problem. There are plenty of things going on all over the world where we could have a tremendous amount of influence. You know, I know somebody served in the military, retired now. And he used to say, you know, it's interesting that no one ever thinks just as a sort of a thought experiment, or stops to think that the United States could effectively blackmail any country on the planet into doing whatever it wanted if we were this, you know, this evil imperialistic monstrosity that some people like to pretend that we are. We actually could do that. You know, we could threaten the total annihilation of really any country. I mean, Russia and China could say, hey, we'll punch back pretty hard, and maybe a few other countries, but not very many. And there's certainly a lot of countries where we have some national security interests where we could bully them to no end, and we don't do that, and that's not in our character as a people, and that's not. And now some people say, "Oh, yes, we do." No, we really don't. You know, we really do try to have positive relationships with as many countries as we possibly can, and I think it's interesting that this notion of a U.S. retreat from the world stage. And people always, and then they always come back with, well, we're in all these bases. Okay, yeah, we are in a lot of bases. And there has been, comparatively, at least to periods of the 20th century, a period of relative peace when it comes to large-scale wars with this U.S. presence all over the world, as well as the U.S. Navy, our Blue Water Navy keeping the shipping lanes open and fighting against piracy and all sorts of other problems that I think could come up. And by the way, we have reporting in just now that a U.S. ship fired warning shots at an Iranian ship or over an Iranian ship or whatever it does near the Straits of Hormuz. I mean, you know, Iran is engaging in provocations, which is so strange, isn't it? Because you'd think that the outreach from the administration, the outstretched hand with $400 million of cash in it, you'd think that that might begin to soften the mullah's attitudes towards us. But if you thought that, you'd be wrong. They are entrenched in their hatred of us. They have to be. They need an excuse for why their country, for why the society that they preside over has so many of the problems it does. It's really such a miserable place. Why so many of the Iranian people don't have an economic future that's anything to be excited about or even to be optimistic about. Why the Iranian people don't have basic freedoms and live in a perpetual theocracy and police state, right? It has to be our fault. It's always our fault. That's kind of what I'm getting at for some people, many of them in this country as well. It's always America's fault. They can find some means of saying, well, if you go back in history far enough, you'll see that America did this, and therefore, I mean, the Iranians are still, I mean, the Iranian regime, I should say, and a fair amount of Iranians, too, are still angry about the Shah. Look, we just gave him cash that we owed to the Shah. I mean, that history hasn't gone away. They're angry about the coup that overthrew Mossadegh. They're angry about all kinds of things. And what you eventually find yourself dealing with is if you take the non-interventionist or isolationist line to its ultimate conclusion, and maybe not the non-interventionist so much, because, again, we've had a couple of failed interventions now in a few countries, and I don't really know what to say about that other than we tried and the people of these countries weren't able to make it work. We tried to help them. Couldn't make it work. I think that's unfortunately going to be the end conclusion in Afghanistan. I also think that we're already seeing that that's in large part the conclusion in Iraq. And then you get into this discussion of, well, there's a difference between invading a country and trying to build it, trying to sort of build the country anew and doing nothing, which I think that's where the Syria discussion often sort of comes off the rails. People say, well, you know, look at Iraq. It was such a disaster. We can't do that in Syria. Okay. The administration is flying airstrikes and has put special operators on the ground and is working with Kurdish militias and doing. They could have done these things 3 years ago. They didn't want to. Waited until 500,000 people had died and the whole thing had become a complete and utter disaster. So that's where you start to see that everyone wants to force on these foreign policy discussions about what's going on in the Middle East. Everyone wants to force the other side into some absolutist position and then just sort of browbeat them. There is a more middle path with many of these issues. And it should always be kept in mind that it's not perfect. It will never be perfect. But doing nothing comes with its own risks and has its own costs. And one of those costs is that other countries in the region will take it upon themselves to fill whatever vacuum is left behind by an absence of U.S. leadership, U.S. military presence, U.S. diplomatic ties, whatever the specific case may be. And it was a discussion I had with some friends about this yesterday. I thought it was interesting. Interesting, to say the least. 888-900-3393. Maybe we could talk a little about ideological subversion the other side of the break. I feel like that would be kind of a fun topic of discussion. We'll bring on Yuri Benzimov, or whatever his name is. I've got some stuff from him. And we could also talk about how Facebook is controlling the news. You want to do that? I don't know. You tell me. Back in a few.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network.
listening to the Buck Sexton Show.
Steve in Michigan, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. What's up, sir?
Well, Buck, you've been talking about Iran, Syria, and all, and I was telling your gal there that we make an attempt to take down Assad here several years ago. I mean, you know, running guns probably out of Libya to the Syrian rebel forces. And then when it's all said and done, we make the deal with the devil, Iran, and this nuclear deal, and then and things continue to spiral there. And I'm just, why were we trying to take down Iran's one of their better allies and then make a deal with Iran at the, you know, a year or two later, and of course the mess in Syria continues on? I mean, how did we get to this point from the administration, short of saying they're either blithering idiots or they got some plan crafted that well, I sure can't figure out where it's going.
Well, it depends on who you ask about where different administration figures were at any point in time. For example, on the issue of Syria, it is now a widely at least said, if not widely accepted, that Hillary Clinton was much more in favor than Barack Obama of taking more decisive action against, certainly against ISIS, and also perhaps against the Assad regime earlier on. Whether you buy that or not, I leave that to you, right? There was a sort of moment in time when there was an anti-Assad resistance that wasn't the Islamic State, that wasn't a version of what had been al-Qaeda in Iraq, and we missed that window, and we allowed the civil war to sort of go in a different direction. Why we would, I mean, that we would fight against, or that we would try to support anti-Assad forces while also trying to get a deal done with Iran is, I mean, that's not surprising at all. We view both of them as regimes that we distrust and dislike. I will say that some of the more recent revelations include that we were unwilling to do the maximum against Assad that we could have, because we didn't want to upset the Iranians, right? That's another, this is the reporting that Jay Solomon from the Wall Street Journal had for us just yesterday or the day before about the red line, right? Obama had this red line about chemical weapon usage. The UN report just came out yesterday. Chemical weapons have been used by the by both the Islamic State in the form of chemical, chlorine bombs, and by the regime with more advanced chemical weapons, by the Assad regime. So they backed off, I think. I think the administration backed off on Assad and backed off on the pressure they could have had because they didn't want to upset the Iranians more. And look, the Iranians were dictating the terms because they knew something very important going into this. Obama needed a deal, because otherwise, what does he point to as his legacy in the Middle East? Pulling out of Iraq and letting ISIS fill the vacuum? That's not great. Finishing the war in Afghanistan? Didn't do that. Libya is a disaster. I mean, you know, where do 8 years of Obama, what does that add up to on the foreign policy scale? And that was why Iran was so important. And the Iranians knew that. And so they were able to get all kinds of things that weren't even necessarily a part of the official deal, but that were reflected in U.S. policy. And I think that Syria is the most obvious example of that. So I hope that's an answer.
Well, I think that covers it well, but I guess I would have said, why even start on Syria in the first place unless it was part of this, quote, Arab Spring issue that just ballooned out of control now, given
Libya, I don't know, man.
Syria, given Iraq, almost ruined us in Egypt. And I just like, wow, what a strategy to even go after Assad.
This is where I pull an Ed O'Neill from Wayne's World and just say the world's a crazy place. The world's a crazy place. Thanks for calling in, Steve. Remember that when he's sitting at the donut shop and gets all weird? Ed O'Neill's great. I was going to mention. Okay, so there's all this stuff out there now about. I'm not taking you down a conspiracy theory track here. We're exploring. We could say we're red-selling this piece a little. Oh, wait, before I say that, we will do Facebook Live at 3 o'clock. So anyone listening who wants to hang out, ask some questions, I'll be going Facebook Live at 3 Eastern, maybe 3:01 or 3:02 Eastern. Depends on how quickly I can get the thing set up in the hut. I'm a production team of one in here, and my technical skills are not what you would call amazing. So we will get that going in here. But, yeah, so 3-ish Eastern time, expect to see some Facebook Live. You can just go to Facebook.com/BuckSexton. I'll be sitting there answering questions, hanging out. Okay, so it is now broadly thought that the Russians want Trump to win for a whole bunch of reasons. I understand those. We've had John Schindler, former NSA, on talk about that, among others, Rebecca Heinrichs from Hudson Institute. We've had plenty of people on to talk about this issue. And I do think that there is some weird bromance between Putin and Trump, and that's all legitimate, and we've talked about that. Okay. But what if the Russians also just want to stir things up a little bit over here? You know, they pay for this channel, RT, Russia Today, which has very limited viewership on the cable side. I don't even think it gets cable ratings because so few people watch it. I do think it's a little weird that General Flynn, well, I don't know if he was a paid contributor or he just went on there a bunch, but a little weird. I would never. They asked me. They used to ask me to go on RT, and I was like, nope, no way. They also used to ask me to go on Al Jazeera America, and I was like, well, we can measure. I think the history of this channel with an egg timer. So, and I was right. Al Jazeera America was not long for the U.S. market, because that's what we need: a bunch of unaccountable Gulf sheikhs writing checks for a news channel in America to reflect the wealthy Gulf Arab perspective, autocrat perspective in America. Yeah, that was a great idea. Really, it was bravo, guys. But, you know, they have all the money they need to push all this kind of stuff without consequence. And so they did. Okay. So RT is out there and RT is pushing all kinds of nonsense on a regular basis. Very pro. I mean, it's not just pro Kremlin. It is a Kremlin, you know, it's like a Kremlin propaganda piece. It's funded by the Kremlin. This is all out there. This is established in the open. We also know that Russian cutouts are releasing very sensitive and, well, not very sensitive, but sensitive and damaging political information now in an effort to openly influence the U.S. presidential election. This is serious stuff. We've had the head of the DNC resign. I mean, nobody really cares about that. You know, I mean, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, whatever. But there have been some consequences already for this. You got Julian Assange, who is doing Russia's bidding, I believe. He's out there talking about how there's going to be this big revelation about Hillary Clinton. I think he's overselling it, by the way. I doubt that there's going to be anything that comes out about Hillary that will make all that much of a difference. But I could be wrong. But there's we get into this discussion of, well, who do the Russians want to win, when there's also another angle to all this as well. What if the Russians just want to undermine any confidence in U.S. elections and U.S. media, in our basic institutions? What if that's really behind a lot of this? Essentially, Russia wins just by causing some form of chaos here, right? By turning us against each other, by making us believe that either the election is rigged or the media is in the tank for... we already know the media is in the tank, but I mean the media is sort of colluding behind the scenes to help some candidates over others. And once that becomes exposed, part of me, of course, is excited to see that stuff or interested to see that stuff. But as this continues on, people might become more cynical and disaffected. And isn't it possible, at least, that that's considered, if not the primary objective of particularly the sort of Russian intrusions into U.S. political discourse, because they have forced themselves into this election in a way they haven't in previous ones. Despite the fact that the KGB, stretching back for decades, had a very clear interest and spent a lot of its effort trying to do just that, to influence U.S. public opinion, right? What could be more important? Why you don't have to prepare the best fighting force in the world to defeat America if America doesn't want to defend itself, right? That's kind of the basics of the thinking the KGB had. And this is also why there were, despite what you will hear, not only agents of the KGB in this country who were stealing secrets, and there were people who were traitors and sending the communist Soviets our military secrets, diplomatic secrets, commercial information that was very valuable.
So, you know, industrial espionage, that sort of thing, and economic espionage efforts. All of that happening. And we're told that never happens anymore. We also had the Soviets funding peace movements in this country and journals of opinion that were all about peace and how we should disarm, and dearmament's very important, all the rest of it, or disarmament. And that all was part of our recent past. We seem to sort of have forgotten it. And now you got the Russian, and now you have Russian intrusions into the election with how it's all rigged. It's all a bunch of elites controlling things from behind the scenes. I was reminded of this. I'm sure many of you have seen some of these clips before. They're pretty interesting. This defector from the KGB, Yuri Bezmenov, talking about ways of undermining an enemy and how really the main enemy, the main adversary, which is what the KGB referred to the United States as during the Soviet period, the ways that they would go about that. And as we have the Russians hacking into emails and releasing them and trying to influence U.S. public opinion about not just who to vote for, but does voting even matter? Can you trust this government? Is the FBI in the pocket of the status? All that kind of stuff gets dragged into this as well. Here's an interview from the 70s. I think it was, or maybe it might be the 80s, whatever. It's a while ago, with Yuri Bezmenov talking about how the KGB used to play the game. Go.
The main emphasis of the KGB is not in the area of intelligence at all. According to my opinion, and opinion of many defectors of my caliber, only about 15% of time, money, and manpower is spent on espionage as such. The other 85% is a slow process, which we call either ideological subversion or active measures, активные мероприятия in the language of the KGB, or psychological warfare. What it basically means is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite of the abundance of information, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interests of defending themselves, their families, their community, and their country. It's a great brainwashing process which goes very slow, and it's divided in four basic stages. The first one being demoralization. It takes from 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. Why that many years? Because this is the minimum number of years which requires to educate one generation of students in the country of your enemy, exposed to the ideology of the enemy. In other words, Marxism-Leninism ideology is being pumped into the soft heads of at least three generations of American students without being challenged or counterbalanced by the basic values of Americanism, American patriotism.
Any of that sound prescient to you? I'm kind of familiar. Demoralization with America, with the political process, with everything that's going on. I feel like there's some echoes of those sentiments right now in this election. And remember, the leader of Russia is a KGB agent, former KGB agent, but is there really such a thing? You don't think he approaches these things from a similar perspective? He doesn't see a lack of U.S. trust in institutions as inherently an advantage to him? I'm just putting it out there. Just a thought. Just mixing it up a bit. We'll be back in a few.
Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton,
the Blaze Radio Network.
You know, team, we haven't had anybody with a British accent on the show today, have we? I feel like we're missing out. We've got some phenomenal Brits that call in here. Whatever you may think of Brexit, which we don't have time to really get into that right now, I have to say, every time this guy Nigel Farage speaks, I'm like, I just feel like he has the most British accent ever. I just love it. And he was talking about the establishment and trying to draw parallels between that situation in the UK and Trump here in this country. And I'm basically just looking for an excuse to play some Nigel Farage, so play it.
If I was an American citizen, I wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton if you paid me. In fact, I wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton if she paid me. If you want change in this country, you better get your walking boots on. You better get out there campaigning. And remember, anything is possible if enough decent people are prepared to stand up against the establishment.
I mean, just listening to it, I feel like I'm sitting next to the Queen, drinking some tea, eating some crumpets, maybe wearing one of those big furry black hats that the dudes in the red jackets outside of Buckingham Palace. You know what I mean? I just feel so British when Nigel Farage is doing his thing. So I don't know. I just want to play that. He's a compelling. He's a charismatic fellow, and he did pull off quite a political coup with the Brexit vote. Tomorrow's going to be free. Tomorrow's Friday, right? Oh my gosh, this week has flown by. Tomorrow's Freestyle Friday. It's the last day I'll be on the air for a few days, so that means we're definitely going to need to hang out. 12 Eastern, of course, as always, from the Freedom Hut Live. Please download today's show. If you share it with a friend or two, you'll be doing me a big solid, and I appreciate that very much. Facebook Live coming up here at 3 Eastern. Until tomorrow, Shields High.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.